I had a good week this week. Oh, by the way, I really appreciate if you guys could go give some nice, put some nice comments out up on iTunes about my podcast. It's always nice to get the good comments. It helps raise the profile of the show. Send the links around. I've been really proud of the guests that we've had. We've got a really cool guest this week that you haven't heard a lot of and I think you're going to find really interesting. I had a great week with my one-man show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak. It's on sale now at telecharge.com. And you use the code PMFAN, PMFAN, you get 50% off. It's my one-man Broadway show. And it's an audience interactive show. Audience members tell stories from their lives. You can come, tell stories, just listen. This week, we had some incredible stories. One was a guy, he lives in Brooklyn with his wife. His wife started going to Lithuania because her mom lives there. She ended up having an affair with a Lithuanian clergyman and is leaving her husband for this guy who's married with two kids and he's a clergyman and apparently incredibly overweight. I'm not making this up. This is real life. This is what's great about the show because you don't have to go very far to find interesting stories. Everybody has one, and that's the theme of the show. Another one is a Moroccan guy who's blind, and you know what? I'll save it for next week so you have something to look forward to. Also, my sponsor, deepdiscount.com, they've been great. Please support them. They help allow me to bring this show to you, and they are having a site-wide sale on everything. Just in time for the holidays, make your list. Go check out thousands and thousands of items on sale. It's CDs, it's DVDs, apparel. They've got everything, okay? I actually picked up Trading Places, a little holiday movie, on sale. I think it was like, I don't know, 10 bucks or something on Blu-ray. And just great movie, funny. I kind of skipped through all the parts except the Jamie Lee Curtis and not having clothes on. That one, I pretty much freeze frame it there. And that's my night. I got problems. But no, it's a great movie. Check it out. They got a lot of great stuff. They also have an ABBA Monopoly game, which I bought. I swear to God, there aren't houses. You sell ABBA singles. And if you go to jail, there's a Swedish massage involved, apparently. No, you got to buy an ABBA Monopoly game. You got to give that out at Christmas. They're going to be talking about you for years. You're going to be a hero. It's really there. It's on the site. Check it out. I bought one. And they have a lot of great deals. Just go to my website, paulmercurio.com, click on the deep discount logo. It'll take you right to their page, and you can see all of the great deals they have on the entire site. They have new releases, too. The complete first season of HBO's boardroom drama Succession. 10 episodes on 3 discs. Get your copy now for a great price at deepdiscount.com. They got a lot of cool stuff. Check it out. And be good to yourself. Buy your favorites. Support my sponsor. They help me. And check out my one-man show, PMFAN, telecharge.com for tickets. And my guest this week, Mr. Mike Baker, CIA covert ops guy. Okay? We actually did this interview in a lead room, so no one could be monitoring us. Really cool conversation about that world of espionage and counterintelligence, something that not a lot of us know about. And this is what I love about doing the podcast is I can bring you things that maybe you haven't, people and things and issues that you haven't heard about. And, you know, open your eyes to life because that's my job. Mike Baker, very interesting conversation, really entertaining, great guy. And I think you're going to enjoy it. This week on the podcast, my pal Mike Baker, a unique individual. Mike spent 17 years as a covert field operations officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, which I think is the CIA. I'm not sure. Is that right?
That's correct. You cracked the code.
There you go. Mike specialized in cafeteria duty, locker room maintenance. No, he was a specialist in counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, counterinsurgency operations. What are you doing on my podcast? You are way more important.
I don't know. I was told by the government to do this, and so that's what I'm doing.
Well, the reason you're on is you've got nothing to do. You're in the middle of Montana at a Comfort Inn right now, so, right?
Yeah, don't make it sound as glamorous as you just did.
Mike is also the co-founder and now president of Diligence, an intelligence investigations, risk management, and security firm that's grown for, you know, leaps and bounds over the last few years. And we're friends because we've appeared on Red Eye with Greg Gutfeld a lot together and had a lot of laughs. So welcome to the podcast. Mr. CIA. This is really
cool. Thank you very much. No, it's great. I really appreciate it.
Now, we have to get one thing out of the way. The wanker graph. Okay. Now, when you and I, we've each taken on the job of, when they had the ombudsman on Red Eye, we would fill in when Andy was not there doing something else. And you would always bring up a graph, call it the wanker graph. And no one could quite figure out where that came from. So let's get that out of the way first. What was the derivation of that?
Well, it's an old briefing tool used in the Intel community. So I think for people that are confused about the ombudsman on Red Eye, that was back in the 80s when they would do a halftime report. But you know what? It was, I don't know. The problem with whenever I would fill in for Andy on Red Eye, what I realized was, I can't do what he was doing, right?
It's hard.
You come up with witty things.
Yeah. I mean, just to fill people in, basically we do a long first act and a second act, and then there'd be a halftime report where Andy would sort of correct any quote unquote mistakes that were made, but it was just an opportunity for him to rag on all of us on the panel, especially guys like you and me who are regulars. And,
right.
But you had to pay attention. So you and I filled in that role, and you have to really pay attention to what like five people are saying and what that tiny elf Greg Gutfeld is yelling. And it's hard. It's a very hard job, or was a hard job.
It was very difficult. And I just realized, you know, that in the first time I did it, I realized there's no way I could do that. A, I just couldn't be bothered to pay attention. And B, I couldn't come up with anything funny, you know, like Andy or you or the other guys could. So the decision I made was, look, I'm just going to not even bother paying attention to what the hell was talked about. And I'm just going to make shit up and, you know, use some charts and graphs because everybody loves charts and graphs because it makes it seem like you know what you're talking about. And it worked for the most part.
Yeah. Well, yes, I think it did. You literally, he would hit in the piece of notebook paper and then, you know, he'd draw for about 20 minutes and then hold it up. And we'd all sit there and look at each other dumbfounded on national television.
I know. The good news was they never told me to stop. They encouraged me to keep going with that piece of nonsense, but it was a lot of fun. I as you know, I mean, I got a great deal of respect for Greg, for Andy, and the dearly departed Bill.
Oh yeah, yeah. We miss him definitely. To miss him on the show. But let's talk about you a little bit because you covert ops. How did that come about? Like, where did you grow up, and like, what prompted you in college? Did you know kind of okay, this is kind of a direction I wanted to go? Because you seem like a guy lost early on in life and just meandering about doing drugs and getting in trouble. That's the impression I get from you, but I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, that was pretty much it. I knocked over a bank and then eventually, you know, they gave me an offer. They said, you can do this or prison. I didn't set out looking for it. And in fact, I was a famously bad college student, which typically would derail your attempts to get into the agency. Mm-hmm. I got there by a very circuitous path. You know, I met some people, I think they sparked on the fact that while I wasn't that bright, I could make good decisions. I had some common sense. I had a pretty high risk appetite. And in fact, the last in-person interview I had at the agency before I found out whether I got in or not was with a legendary Cold War era officer that was there. And he was, at the time, he was running one of our divisions. And I remember sitting in front of his desk, and he was going through my file. And this was before, you know, and he was going to tell me whether I got in or not. And so he's going through my file. Finally, he looks at me and he says, after this long period of silence, which you later found out was a very good interrogation technique. You know, people don't like the space in between. They don't like those silences.
Oh, is that right?
Row. Oh, absolutely. And it's a very good technique, even if you're just doing something as pedestrian as a job interview, right? And just let the silences grow. People don't like that. You can learn a lot in there. But what this guy didn't realize was I had absolutely nothing to say. So I was perfectly comfortable with the silence.
There wasn't a lot going on upstairs. It was very kind of empty up there anyway. So, right, you're just kind of, now there's a lot of brain activity, but then probably.
Right, exactly. To me, it was just like, you know, another day, you know, just nothing happening. And I stared at him and he stared at me. And finally, but he did look at me and he said, you know, you have the lowest GPA of anybody we've ever recruited in the operations group. And he was serious. He wasn't a man to kid around. He was serious. But thank God they made that decision. And I had a wonderful time.
So what is it? What do you go through to get into the CIA? And generally, I assume you became, you know, a senior ops officer. You were on the other side of the table interviewing people to come in. What are the things that sort of generally keep people out? I mean, the obvious things are, you know, drug use or, you know, big crime. But I mean, like, generally, like, what do you go through? What are some of the mental games that they put you through? That kind of thing. I'm really fascinated by that.
Well, you know, you're right about what keeps you out. I mean, lifestyle issues are what keeps casts most people's files aside. And they get a lot of great applications. They get a tremendous number of applications nowadays, particularly after 9/11.
A buddy of mine works for MITRE Corporation, and he's very senior now, and he's got a high clearance. And they talked to a lot of us, like his friends, and we did a lot of stupid stuff in high school, like driving in pot. Like, they actually didn't let them talk to me because he thought that I would be like, I was not a good person to talk to, so he wouldn't let them talk to me. But they really go deep, right?
Yeah, well, they do, and I mean, I will say that the background checking process, as we all learned from, you know, incidents like with Snowden and some other cases, could be improved at times. But the agency tends to be pretty anal retentive about the whole thing. But it's the lifestyle issues that really cause problems for most. Even folks that have great language skills, have, you know, very good grades, have spent time overseas, whatever it may be. If they've been involved in particularly narcotics, that's still the one, even though the agency and the FBI and others realize they have to adapt to some degree. Mm. You know, the reality is they still don't because they have such a high number of applications they can choose from.
And is the concern if the person potentially has a problem that they can be compromised by, you know, sort of, you know, selling information to feed their drug habit, that kind of thing? Is that the concern?
Well, potentially, but it's more of a self-discipline issue from their perspective. It's still kind of an old school mindset, and it's basically, look, you know, we get so many people applying that we can set this bar where we want to right now, and where we want to is to see that, you know, people haven't engaged in behavior that, you know, is detrimental or, you know, perhaps destructive, or as you said, I mean, could cause some problems down the road. So that's one of those issues. And then in terms of what do you look for, you know, the other side of the fence, you're looking for, I mean, as I found out, it doesn't have to be great grades, although, you know, typically they do look for that. But there's a lot of other issues there. There's language aptitude. If you show up, all things being equal, and you've got two candidates and one speaks Farsi or Pashtun or Urdu or Arabic or, you know, Russian or Korean or whatever, they're going to have an edge on someone who doesn't have any language skills.
Because you can put them right into the field and they can adapt, they can go undercover, they can do all of that. They can do counterterrorism and really kind of blend in.
And it also shows an ability to learn, you know, additional languages. And it shows, you know, they just rate that very highly. They also rate, you know, overseas experience. You know, did you grow up overseas, which I did.
Were you a military brat? What was your background in that way?
Yeah, no, my dad was, you know, he was military, but it was old school. He was a pilot in World War II. And before that he was in the oil business. And so then he went back in the oil business and then he went back in the military. So he was kind of a mixture of both. And he was bouncing back and forth because of his business, but also, as the needs dictated from the military and the times. But, so I grew up as in my family overseas, but they look for that. They look for common sense. They look for sort of these other issues, a risk appetite, an ability to make decisions without perfect information.
How do you assess somebody's risk appetite, and how do you assess their ability to make decisions? Like, what kind of tests do they put you through in that?
Well, they put you through a whole lot of kind of very pedestrian, you know, psych tests. There's until you're just about ready to scream. I mean, which of course then it would disqualify you if you did. But you get my point.
Give me one example of a risk. How you can assess my risk appetite? Like, what do I have to do, or what do you put me through? Do I get dropped in a vat of like crickets? Like, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, and that actually, a vat of crickets is actually, I don't know where you got that information from, but now we have to figure that one out because That's a standard interrogation technique. But no, you know what? There's part of it is literally sort of from a psychology perspective. And it's obviously not my wheelhouse, but you go through a battery of exams. You talk to a lot of the shrinks. You know, they have their own medical evaluation group with, you know, a team of psychiatrists. You go through a lot of that. You go through a lot of assessments. You go through a lot of scenarios and role playing. With officers that are involved in the recruitment side, they get a pretty deep dive on the person's makeup and personality and characteristics. And you know, over the years, I guess they put together, you know, sort of in a very scientific way, you know, what all this adds up to, and they feel pretty confident that the folks they choose are of the right mindset, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they do all of this before, you know, you get your go ahead, because they don't want to, you know, they're not going to throw you into training. I mean, you wash out of training. They have a fairly high washout rate, but they try to lock it in pretty well so that they're maximizing the chance to get everybody through training.
What generally washes most people out in training? Is it the physical demands or the psychological, emotional? What is the thing that's a big hurdle for people?
You know, it's a bit of all those things. I mean, everyone's a little bit different, you know. Mm-hmm. So for some folks, you know, the physical aspects of it, you know, there's no big deal there. For some, it's sort of the constant stress or the competitive nature of it all, because you're competing against, you know, the folks in your recruiting class and mm-hmm. also just the sense of, you know, where you're going. So there's a lot of reasons why people might, you know, eventually just drop out. Maybe they don't, you know, make it through the interrogation, you know, part of it, whatever it may be. And you're constantly evaluated. So during the course of the training program, which, you know, when I was in, you know, ran for a little over 2 years.
2 years of a training program?
Yeah.
Now, are you in the field? Are you like in a facility? Like in a,
well, you're bouncing all around. You're going to various facilities. You're going overseas. You're doing a lot of different things.
It's gotta be really exciting as a young single guy, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And although you can't, what are you going to do? You can't say anything about it. If you do, I mean, we had some idiots that would, you know, go into a bar and try to, you know, pick up chicks by telling them, you know, that they were in, you know, the agency training program. Believe it or not, that's absolutely true. And of course they didn't last.
That's hilarious. Yeah, like a big, they have the jacket with the CIA letters on the back, and they're walking around like the FBI, like that big yellow lettering. And so 2 years, I didn't realize that. And are you are you sort of grinding it out, or how was it for you?
Well, you know what? I'm not a deep thinker, as you know.
Well, that's clear.
And so
you're great with graphs, though. You're great with the third grade graphs. That's your wheelhouse.
That was my thing. When we got to that 2 month section on charts and graphs, I excelled. I was like a rocket, and I think that's what really pulled me through. But no, I tend not to be a deep thinker. I figure, look, you've got only so many options on any issue. You've got only, you know, so many things you have to worry about.
But I think that's good in that role, right? Because in the field, you got to be decisive, move, and act quickly. And if you're a guy that's, you know, maybe overly smart, if you will, or whatever it is, or sort of overly analytical, that could get in your way, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you wait around, I mean, typically if you wait around for all the information that you're hoping to get, then something really bad's going to happen. So
explain that, what that means a little bit for the listeners. In other words, if you're waiting around, like at some point you've got to go with a gut decision based on the information you have in front of you. Because if you wait one more day or two more days, the bad thing that you're trying to prevent could happen. Is that what that means?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you've got to get off the X at some point. You got to make a decision on things, you know, and if you're talking about, you know, an operation, then you're not going to get all, it's not like the movies or the beach books, you know, things aren't always black and white. And so you hope to get sufficient information to understand what the risks are, because you're always doing a risk versus gain calculation. But, you know, you also have to have the understanding that, you know, it's just never going to happen that you get so much information that you feel comfortable that you're making an absolutely correct decision. What you're doing is you're basically, you know, taking a calculated risk every time. But if you, if you wait, I guess that being the point, if it's like driving into an ambush. You know, you got to make a pretty quick decision as to whether what you've got up ahead is a problem or not before you get on the X.
But isn't an ambush always a problem?
You got to make a decision on how to react. In other words, you don't want to just drive right into it.
Are they putting you through pretty much every conceivable scenario in those 2 years so that you, at least in training, have had some experience reacting to all? Not that you can ever come up with every possible scenario, but is that sort of a big part of that training? Like, you're ambushed, it's four people, this and that, it's mountainous region, like all of those scenarios get thrown at you?
Yeah, they try to make it as comprehensive as possible. And they're basing it obviously on past, you know, operations, on past events, on you know, sort of the threats that you're facing nowadays. And they're trying to adapt it. And they also understand that, you know, how you react in training, you know, isn't necessarily how you're going to react in the real world. But at the same time, you've got to train for everything and you've got to train constantly. So because, it's like a gunfight. If you haven't been practicing constantly and it's not part of your muscle memory, then, you know, things are going to get fucked up and you're not going to react properly. So it's, you know, you just constantly train. And that's the same with, you know, certainly the same with the elite law enforcement. It's the same with spec ops and others. If you're not doing, then theoretically you should be training.
Well, so basically what you're saying is you are Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther movie, where he at all times would be on guard for his trusty sidekick,
Kato,
who would come in and in the middle of the night, they'd karate chop each other. That's your life. Like right now, like you'll go to bed in the Comfort Inn and at some point one of your guys will come in and attack you. Is that right?
Well, yeah, either that or a Syrian hit team, or actually Kato himself, whom I did actually meet Kato at a fundraiser in London several years back. I was sitting at a table and I looked at the table next to me and I looked at this guy and I actually said out loud, and I was reminded about this because I was sitting with a bunch of guys, and I actually said out loud without even realizing it, like I had Tourette's in them. I said, "Oh my God, it's Kato." and he turned around and he looked at me, because I guess people hadn't recognized him, and we had a great time. I got a couple of pictures with him and we had a nice little chat. And yeah, so anyway, that's my one geek out with a celebrity.
That's hilarious. So anytime during that 2 years, were you like, what was the biggest eye opener, or just where you're just, I don't know if I can finish this, or this part of this is just not connecting with me?
You know what? I don't want to, you know, beat a dead horse, but I'm a pretty simple person. So I never had a moment where I thought, no, I don't think I'm gonna make this. You just have to put, you know, one foot in front of the other. You always you take it in bite-sized chunks. And right. If the folks that overthink it or think, oh my God, I've got another year to go, or oh my God, this is just so difficult, or it's you know, there's ambiguity here, or there's gray area, and I can't figure it out. I mean, you know, honestly, just that's what I tell my little boys. You know, 6, 4, and 2, just get on with it and quit whining.
Yeah, and then you shoot them in the neck with a dart, right? That's part of the CIA training.
Hey, look, they got to learn. And so.
you go Kato on them. So why did you decide? Explain for people who, you know, may not know or understand what counterterrorism is, counter-narcotics, and why you decided to go into that sort of area of the
ops. Well, you don't have a lot of say sometimes in what you're going to end up doing. And part of it is, in from a 30,000 foot view with the agency, it follows the tasking from the White House, and it follows the government budgets and everything. So when I got in, a big part of what we were doing was counterinsurgency. You know, sort of think back to, you know, I mean, big issues then were some Asian insurgencies, Central America. And then we moved into the drug wars. And we got very heavily involved in the drug wars in Asia.
I don't want names and stuff. Obviously you can't reveal, but like explain to people. So are you going undercover in Asia? What does insurgency mean in that respect in terms of the drug wars or?
Counterinsurgency is different. Counterinsurgency, you can kind of think about it in terms of just paramilitary operations, working with local military to, you know, beat back whatever the insurgency is. And back then it was, you know, we had some very nasty communist insurgencies that were going on and causing a lot of trouble. Then drug wars, everything from interdiction operations to recruiting
sources within the various drug organizations to tracking targets and obtaining, you know, high value targets in the narcotics business, to you know, again, to working out in the Golden Triangle, trying to interdict you know, everything from caravans to you know, factories and cook shops and everything. So it, and then we moved into terrorism. That's where obviously most people nowadays think, okay, well, that's where the agency is. They're terrorism. And you know, the agency at the end of the day is, you know, the big issue is you stealing information. I mean, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but that's what the agency acquires information to protect our national security interests.
Right. And so, in other words, there's communications between two factions of Al Qaeda, and through satellite, through information, through locals that you've developed relationships with. You're trying to intercept that information to stay one step ahead of them and find them and take them out or whatever has to happen, right?
Right. Or you know, Russian movements in Ukraine or North Korean efforts to export weapons technology to Pakistan or Pakistan's efforts to export technology to Iran or whatever the secrets may be. And you're either, and this is the traditional work of the agency. This is how it got started, was to, the insurgency operations, narcotics operations, the terrorist operations, that's all part and parcel of it too. And we've always had a paramilitary group inside the agency because it started out of World War II. But, you know, I think sometimes the worry is that particularly after 9/11, the mindset has been, you know, not enough of, look, we've got to engage in traditional old school espionage because that's what the agency often does best.
Well, what you feel like we got away from that after 9/11? It seems like we'd go in the other direction, and that would be we'd put that pedal to the metal, so to speak.
We got away from it in the sense that we beefed up, or the perception is, you know, and to some degree it's true, we beefed up sort of this idea that no, we're out in the field, we're out in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular. I mean, our biggest bases and stations were out there.
You mean our military presence,
our agency presence over there in terms of what the agency's doing, trying to support the battlefield operations. And honestly, what you end up doing is you end up sending a lot of your first two officers over into those places. And then they get rotated to another, you know, place for another 6 months or 12 months. And so that's what they're used to. Now, you're not conducting, you know, classic clandestine espionage operations in Iraq or Afghanistan. It just doesn't happen because, you know, the security issues mean that you have to travel everywhere with a fairly obvious fire team and support for security purposes. So you're not having those clandestine communications and meetings and recruiting. So what I mean is in part over the past 10 years, 11 years, we've created a lot of officers inside the agency that have spent a lot of time in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan in support of, you know, our military operations, but not pursuing traditional classic espionage.
Is that the reason then that we're not able to sort of, you know, stay ahead of this at times with regard to terrorism out of that region of the world, because you don't have that opportunity for classic terrorism classic espionage, because you have to be surrounded by a fire team, as you put it?
Well, it's a tough target to begin with. You know, whether you're talking about Iran and trying to understand the nuclear weapons, or whether you're talking about Pakistan, or you're talking about Al Qaeda, or, you know, terrorist targets have always been difficult. You know, go back to the Japanese Red Army or Baidamanov or 17 November, or they've always been difficult to penetrate because they're closed.
Compare that to difficult to penetrate for what reason? Just that they've sort of, they know the region so well and sort of how.
Well, they're small organizations and they're very insular. And, you know, you look at Al Qaeda as a recent example now, but, you know, not dissimilar to other old school terrorist organizations. You know, they deal with people they know. So, you know, I'm going to pass this message to my cousin. He's going to give it to his second cousin, and that's how we're going to communicate. Or, you know, we're not going to bring somebody in on a support cell or an operation unless we know them and they've been vetted through our family connections or whatever it may be. So it's always been difficult to do that, which is why we, with terrorism, you always tend to rely very heavily on our other services, you know, our allies like the Jordanians or the Kuwaitis or the Israelis or whomever.
So why are they able to sort of infiltrate on an espionage level more effectively than we are?
Well, it's, I mean, it's their, first of all, it's their backyard. And second of all, they've, you know, they tend to blend in better, you know, more cultural awareness,
that's
better
true.
Language,
you are,
obviously.
You are kind of pasty and white. That is.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. I mean, however, I, you know, if we have an Icelandic operation, I'm kicking ass.
You're going, is the,
yeah.
Is the methodology that you use in espionage, for terrorism, the same for drug insurgency, and the same for nuclear weapon insurgency? Is it the basic methodology to go in sort of, I would imagine, first establish strong relationships with locals who then you can use to gain information? I mean, just walk me through kind of how one sort of builds a base of operation in that regard.
Well, yeah, you're right in a big picture sense, you know, that, you know, it's not much new under the sun, and methodologies don't necessarily change based on the target. So if your target is you know, tech transfer, your target is narcotics, or your target is terrorism or whatever it may be, or just, you know, you're looking to recruit somebody who can provide information on the actions of their government that's hostile to the U.S., you know, you're in a way, this is sort of a big picture thing, I'm oversimplifying. But, you know, what are you doing? You're looking for a source, I mean, frankly. And you're looking for a source that you can understand what their motivations are, what their weaknesses are, what your points of leverage might be.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. So what motivates some of these people? Are we paying them off? Like, what motivates some of these people to give up one of their own countrymen or to start helping an American operation?
That's really crass to suggest we would pay somebody for that sort of information. I can't believe it. I should just hang up now.
You should. What are you going to do? You're going to in Montana. You know, what are you going to? We got nothing.
Shocked. I know. What am I going to do? I'm going to wander down to the Blue Goose Saloon.
Getting a gun.
Yeah, but you know what? There's a lot of different reasons. There's a lot of different motivations that people will do something like that. Now, usually it's not ideology. Now, having said that, that's what people will like to say. They say, well, if they get caught, then typically they'll say, well, you know, it's, you know, they'll try to give it some sort of high and mighty, lofty purpose. But usually it's a very base reason. It's because they feel as if they have been disrespected by their superiors, or they're not taken seriously. They've gotten in a row with their boss, whatever it may be. It's sometimes it's as simple as that, and they're pissed off, and they continue to be pissed off, and you give them an outlet. You give them a way to get back at, you know, whomever it is that they're upset with. And sometimes it's as simple as money. Sometimes it's more, you know, heartfelt. Maybe they feel as if their children have no future in whatever country it is that they're living in, and so they're looking for some way to try to create an opportunity for their family. I've seen that, and that's, you know, that's about as good as it gets in terms of a motivation, because they're doing it for some reason that you can actually understand, as opposed to some really base. And sometimes, you know, the people are very, you know, the people that you're looking to recruit, you know, they're not all, hookers with hearts of gold. I mean, they're, you know, a lot of them are really nasty people. And
yeah, it's not like that
can be problematic, you know, because you're always having to assess what they're like. So.
Yeah. Well, that's where your life must be tense in that, because you never can fully trust somebody, right? You're always looking over your shoulder.
Yeah, and you got to try to stay ahead of what they're doing and what's happening with them, from both from a counterintelligence perspective, you know, have they been turned by their own service or whatever it may be, but also, you know, what's happening in their life. Are they going off the rails and suddenly they're a problem and they're going to get everybody wrapped up? But so there's a lot of things that go on in it, but it's a fascinating business. If you overthink it, you know, then you can have problems. And so I think I was in good standing there, too, because I also didn't overthink it.
Did you ever find yourself in situations, again, you don't have to mention names, but just out in the field, and this is like really hairy, like this might be it for me, or the other side of that, or would be anything just funny that happened that, you know, just turned out to be hilarious, you know, just in a caught in a moment with something that was, you know, just, I don't know, just turned out to be actually a bit of a...
There were a lot of times where you realize you'd come off of something and you realize nobody else is doing this right now. Anyway.
Like what?
On the planet.
Give me an example. Like you're, you just, you just, you, are you undercover at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you'd operate under, you know, and I'm not giving up anything because this has all been out there, but, you know, you operate under, you know, various aliases, third country aliases, whatever it may be. And that's always fun. If you like, and I did, I enjoy, as you can tell, I can talk for England. So I enjoyed the acting part of it. If you do that, then that's part of it. You have to be confident. You have to be, you know, able to carry off a lot. And so I enjoyed that aspect.
You did say real, first of all, I'm hoping one of your aliases was something sexy, like, Bruce Dirkler or something like that. Like almost,
you know, what? I actually have one of the few pieces of documentation I was able to keep, was a using a name that was one of my favorites, was Theodore Lovelance. And yeah,
that is my new nickname for you. I mean, what's up, Teddy? How's it going, bro?
Yeah, it's not easy to sneak that by the documentation people, but you adapt to a lot of different things. You have to be a quick study, all of that stuff. But yeah, you do things occasionally. You do something, and I can't go into, you know, any detail. But you know, there were times from operations where you would realize you were just very fortunate. You were doing something that nobody else was doing. You had that, you know, and it was really, and you weren't doing it because you were getting a lot of money, because we never got paid very well. You know, it's government pay. But you were doing it because it was just sometimes, because you knew it was an important, you know, thing to do on behalf of your country. Sometimes it just was a lot of fun.
It was cool. And you said in an article, like, real spies are like actors. And, when you're in that role, but you kind of have to split your mind and be listening and attentive as Mike Baker, not Theodore Loveland, like that this guy's not buying it, or I feel like this guy's catching on to me. Or how do you have to be a really good read of people to do what you did, right? And how do you maintain that kind of level of, you know, being buried behind the character? How do you do that?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of it is you have to like people a lot, even when they're not, you know, people that you would normally associate with. You have to find them interesting.
Right.
And I think, you know, part of it is you have to have an inflated self-confidence. even when it may not be deserved. But I think, you know, there's...
And trust
there's,
what you do. No,
I've never been accused
scared.
Of not having self-confidence.
You're not sitting there going, oh, Jesus, you're not shitting your pants in any of this? Come on. Like, was there a moment where there were times, I want a story. Give me a story, man. Give my listeners a story. Was there a moment where you're like, you know, I want to hear that you were in this bar in Iraq and, you know, there were four guys surrounding you and you felt like you were playing poker, but anything like happened where you're like close to going, uh-oh, I'm going to be made here?
Well, yeah, there were times. Yeah. And Iraq and Afghanistan are not, again, are the best places, you know, operating overseas are, you know, places that are not, you know, battlefields, because battlefields is not, you know, that's, you're not going to get into situations like that.
Russia, Korea, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could be in a, you know, in Macau, or you could be in Algeria, or you could be, you know, in places like that where, you know, you're engaged in an operation that's really interesting there were times that you know, you actually realized this is all really very, very serious. Yeah. And there's a potential problem here that, you know, may not end well. But at the end of the day, again, it's all part and parcel of, you know, did you do your homework? Do you understand, you know, what you're involved in? Do you understand what the odds are? Do you understand what, you know, what the risks are? Do you understand what you need to do to get out of it? You know, muscle memory, again, sort of the training and just constant training. And so, right. You know, the key was, unlike with 24, where Jack Bauer's a bullet magnet, the key was, you know, make sure you get in, you get out. Nobody ever knows you're there. That's a successful operation.
Yeah, you said one time that if your car is blowing up, you haven't done your job properly. And
right.
I'm quoting you. And in that regard, that makes a lot of sense. So when your night is over, are you back kind of getting ready for the next day by getting fed more intelligence on the people that you're undercover with, and sort of where are you trying to move them to? I guess trying to get information from them, trying to get them to expose themselves so they can be arrested? Like, what is the game at that point?
Well, it's all, I mean, you know, every operation is different and all the operational objectives are different. And so you never, I mean, it depends. I mean, we could spend all day talking about the various types of things that, you know, services are engaged in out there. But at the end of the day, the agency, in a big picture sense, the agency is all about long-term intelligence, long-term sources. So you're not looking to wrap something up. I mean, unless it's a high-value target or, you know, but even if it's an, look at the drug wars, you know, and that, in those cases, you wanted long-term sources. You wanted the ability to collect, to understand the extent of the network, to get all the targets possible, you know, so that, and then eventually, yeah, of course it's going to get wrapped up. But unlike law enforcement, which is like, okay, let's burn the source because, you know, we can make the arrest. The intel operations are always more long-term. You're looking.
So in other words, you keep that lower level guy, let him operate in the field and deal some drugs on the corner because he's going to be a stepping stone to get the guy, the drug lord. You've got a bigger picture, long range view of this from an intelligence community standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, so if you've got a support guy in a terrorist cell, for instance, and all they do is, you know, rent safe houses for, you know, a terrorist organization, then you're not going to wrap him up just because he's renting safe houses. What do you want to do? You want to know, well, how's he paying for them? So who's providing the funding? So who's the financier for this? And then you want to know, well, how are they communicating? So who's responsible for getting the phones or whatever it may be? And then who's actually using it? And eventually, you may get to the point where you've got to pull the trigger and take care of the situation. But your goal is a longer view. You're looking further down the road.
What was your view of the world before you got into the CIA, and how did it change over the course of 17 years and afterwards? I would imagine it opened your eyes quite a bit.
Well, I mean, I spent a lot of time overseas when I was growing up, and I think also the time that I grew up. In part, I mean, you know, was pretty fucked up as a kid. I mean, I remember, you know, I didn't understand it or process it necessarily, but, you know, you remember things like the Munich Olympics and how fucked up that was. And suddenly, you know, now the Olympics don't mean what they used to mean, right? And then, you know, it was a fairly turbulent time, the hijackings, all the rest of it. So by the time I got into the training program, we knew that, you know, the world was pretty fucked up. And so that part of it wasn't a surprise. And I've never been I've never been sort of a rose colored glasses person. I've always felt like, you know, and that was part and parcel of it too. You know, you get some people who might come into the agency and they question, oh, I don't know if we should be doing this or that. And again, I never was one of those people. I thought, okay, fine. That's the task. Let's get it done and move on.
Did your view of the world change at all, or become colored?
Nah, it's still fucked up.
So you're still a jaded prick is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still a cynical douchebag. In fact, that was one of my other aliases, cynical douchebag. So,
is there a government that's particularly challenging to do espionage against? Is Russia particularly good at it? Are there ones that tend to sort of, you know, they got it down right, or was it just?
Well, Russia's good. Russia's service has always been good. They got kind of a shotgun approach, this sort of a brute force thing where they just throw a lot of resources at things, but they've got a pretty good long view.
What does that back up a second? What does that mean, a shotgun approach, a long range? In other words, does that mean that they just manpower, or what does that mean?
Well, manpower, but they'll go out and they'll pitch 50 potential targets, you know, whereas with the agency, you know, you tend to be a little bit more focused. You'll say, okay, we got to really work this, make sure that this is the right source, potential source. And then if it is, then okay, then we're going to finally get this recruitment pitch over to them. And the Russians are just like, fuck it. Let's just ask. Let's just throw.
When you say, lots of people. When you say throw pitches in this case means, in other words, you go to somebody and say, hey, we're recruiting you to give us information and we'll.
Right, right. You try to get people to turn for whatever reason, for whatever the purpose or objective is. So, you know, and the Chinese are extremely good. The Chinese have a very long view. They don't, you know, they're happy to put their, you know, assets out there and, you know, 20 years down the road, maybe they'll, you know, eventually get in a job that's going to be, you know, good. And that'll be great for them. But, you know, we tend to have a shorter view. You know, we like to, you know, have things happen tomorrow. So, You know, one of the things that the Chinese do better than we do is they take this longer view in the development of information, and they're also very aggressive. They just steal more information out there than you can imagine.
Is that right? And do you find? I mean, obviously the Snowden thing was huge, and you know where we are now in terms of NSA spying. And did you feel? I mean, obviously Snowden really compromised things. Why does it get to that point? And how do you prevent that when you have these third party contractors coming in, and you can only know so much about people, you know?
Right. No, it was. You know, Snowden, and I get it. There's a lot of people that think, oh, great, he started a dialogue, you know, said something important, so he's a you know, just a whistleblower or maybe even a hero. But I mean, I get that. I don't agree with it at all, but I get it. I understand why some people are thinking that way. You know, he's caused a great deal of damage, of harm. And regardless of what people may like to think, who have a romanticized vision of him, the Chinese and the Russians have all that information that he walked out the door with. And we've already been seeing indications and the implications of that.
Can you talk about what those implications are? What have you been seeing? Because you probably are more attuned to it than the average person, since that's your world.
Yeah, and this is the problem with anytime you talk about this, is that, you know, you say, okay, well, look, this is the case, and then someone says, well, give me specifics, and, you know, we're not in the business of giving specifics, and so then the response, and I understand that, is, oh, well, yeah, fine, you're just making that shit up then.
Oh, no, and, I get it.
You know,
you're a pussy. I get it. You're a pussy.
Yeah.
I know.
What yeah, exactly. That's exactly exactly right. But
no, I wasn't saying that to challenge you. I'm fascinated by this and trying to learn, because that does make sense to me that things have been compromised as a result of that. And I'm not necessarily against NSA spying if it's going to keep me safe. I mean, there do need to be limits, and I think we both agree on that. So then, how do you get a healthy balance of spying but not too much spying on Americans?
Right.
And people abroad, because there does have to be some limitations. It can't just be, you know.
No, exactly. You know, and I agree with that.
But as somebody who's been on the inside of that, without revealing any names, give my listeners an idea of, like, how can you limit an institution's ability to spy like that so that they can still do something effectively, but not just trample over people at the same time? How can that happen? How can you do that?
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's important to note that, the metadata that we've been talking about is means nothing. Metadata is I could give you a truckload of metadata and you wouldn't know what the hell it is. You wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of it. And you'd have to go out and get yourself a FISA court order, and then you'd have to drill down on a particular subject to get information that's going to tell you something, as opposed to what Google or Amazon are currently collecting, which is pretty impressive amounts of personal data. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you're right. You got to limit this. My concern with the NSA collection is not that they're doing it. I really don't care. And I'd spend enough time peeking behind the curtain that this is my perspective anyway, based on my experiences and is that, unless you're engaged in criminal activity or terrorist activity, the government really doesn't care about you.
Yeah.
And that, but here in America, we do have this unique thing where most people think their lives are so freaking interesting that the government, of course, is going to watch them.
Right. And, so the bottom line is, if I'm cheating on my wife or I was not honest with my taxes, that's not what they care about.
No, they don't. They honestly. But again, I understand people are going to be. They're going to be skeptical. They're going to laugh at that and go, well, of course you're going to say that because look where you used to do. But from my perspective, you know, the concern I've got is, look, I'd like to see them be more operationally focused, right? So if you're doing collections, then you should be doing them for specific purposes, specific targets. You know, oftentimes you don't have. You know, you're not going to be able to say, okay, well, that individual there, I want to collect information on, because you're not going to know about that individual, you know, but you do say, okay, this particular group I'm concerned about. Therefore, I'm going to have a more focused approach in how I gather information overseas. And that's what all this really started on, was our ability to collect information on overseas targets where the communications route themselves through the U.S. That's, you know, underlying all of this. That was
But then it spread to people in the U.S. And I think what you're saying is it makes sense, but I'll be the devil's advocate for pro NSA spying for a moment. You can make the argument, you got to just cast a wide net now because Americans don't want to be bombed again, and we don't want another 9/11. And so is that part of the problem, that the NSA feels like it's got a gun to its head, no pun intended, that they need to kind of just collect everything and then sift through it like a guy mining for gold and see if they get any nuggets. Is that what you're saying the problem is?
Well, yeah, a part of it is, yeah, the reality is that it's tough to be more focused. But the reality is also that when you collect vast amounts of just even that metadata, you know, my worry is I just don't want it all sitting in a basement somewhere and never actually being, you know, proven to be relevant.
Right. Describe that a little bit more for people. What does that mean? Like, what kind of data are we talking about?
Metadata is simply a number called and the duration of time. It really leads you nowhere other than to say, okay, I've got one dot here. Now I need to connect more dots. Therefore, I need to drill down into that to understand, you know, what the pattern was and the linkages that are involved. But, you know, again, I'm a small government guy. I don't want the government involved in, you know, anything that it shouldn't be involved in, and just, you know, stay out of my kitchen and all the other issues. You know, so this is a tricky issue. I understand that. It's just that I think everybody forms their opinions based on their life experiences. My life experiences have been such that I'm not paranoid about, you know, the government coming after me because A, they're so dysfunctional. B, they just can't keep secrets anymore. Mm-hmm. And C, I really do believe, look, unless you're engaged in, again, terrorist or criminal activity, they don't give a shit.
Right. But the problem is that at the end of the day, and I agree with a lot of that, but the other side of that argument is at the end of the day, and yes, I did, if I said this on Red Eye, I'd be getting yelled at for saying at the end of the day, and I've said it three times now. You know, institutions are people. Right. And there are people, and I always say this, that power in the hands of the wrong person is a very dangerous thing. So there's going to be somebody along that chain, and it's a very long chain of people who are going to abuse that power. And that's the thing, right? I don't think anybody sits in a secret enclave at the top of Langley and says, okay, we're going to collect data on everybody and really rip people's lives apart. I think that their intentions are good, and sometimes execution isn't great, or a modus operandi isn't great. And then you add to that, you layer in maybe somebody who overextends. I mean, the history is rife with it. Nixon, you know, up and down the chain. Like, that's the issue. And how... Yeah, I don't know that you can square the two, right? Because you're going to have.
Well, I don't think you can, and I don't disagree with what you're saying, and I think that there's truth there, and I think you always have to have a healthy dose of skepticism about the capabilities and intention of government, whatever administration's in charge, and you have to try to always have a dialogue and also checks and balances. Now we do actually have checks and balances that have. You know, actually worked, even though, you know, people want to, there's this image that somehow this thing ran amok and there were just crimes being committed left and right. And if you actually peel that back, you're hard pressed to find anything other than, well, there's a potential here for misuse of this. And I don't disagree with that, but you know, it's just, you know, I'm conflicted because I also know that there's a lot of bad going on out there. And it's not just happy, you know, circumstance that we haven't had another major attack on U.S. soil.
You wrote an article for Fox News that about the underwear bomber and the leak of the information and how it compromised an ongoing operation. And explain your theory on that a little bit, because to me it was like, okay, well, if the leak was the leak, but it did stop the bombing, so. Isn't all no harm, no foul there? Explain
well,
that.
Yeah, that was also about sort of the inability of people to keep their yap shut nowadays and with, you know, just sort of damn the consequences it may have on important existing operations and sources that we have in place. So, you know, that particular instance, what happened was they basically blew an existing very important operation by essentially saying that, yeah, we've known about this for some time, which, you know, our enemies aren't stupid. So immediately there was an understanding that they had a source inside working against them, and that just got, you know, shut down, and it got people killed. So there's, you know, there's consequences to politicians wanting to rush to the podium and mm-hmm. you know, take credit for successes or talk about things, you know, with a political angle to it. You know, and those consequences are sometimes extremely serious.
Well, I think also it probably, this gets back to what you said the Chinese are good at, sort of looking and taking a long-term view of some of this and doing a slow burn, right? By essentially revealing who, you know, that there might be a source inside. There's probably even bigger targets that they were going up the food chain after, right? And that got compromised, I would imagine, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, nothing happens in a bubble. So you lose one source, and it's not, okay, well, we just lost that source. We've lost the potential for, you know, for extending that operation and for getting the next target who's up on the food chain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you know, but part of the problem also is, you know, we're operating and the agency is very used to getting its ass kicked constantly and being a scapegoat because it's a great scapegoat because it doesn't defend itself because it can't defend itself. What are you going to do? You're going to say, well, let me tell you about this operation.
Right.
And, you know, so the folks who, you know, view, you know, the intel community or the agency in particular is, you know, sort of against their interests, always find the agency to be a good target because there's not a lot of pushback there.
Theoretically, what is the NSA? Just got a couple more questions and we wrap it up. But what is the NSA relationship to the CIA theoretically on paper supposed to be? And what is it in real life in terms of how they work together?
Oh, it's very good. I mean, yeah, the NSA and the agency have long, long history together.
Are they co-equals or is it a support? Is NSA support for CIA? Like, what is the reality of it?
No, the CIA is really the top dog. Yeah. Much, you know, better looking people. Smart people.
They've got a Mike Baker. If they have a Theodore Loveland, they don't, you know what I mean? That says,
they can accomplish. They're equals. They're co-equals. They're both doing incredibly important things. The NSA is a fantastic organization with some of the brightest people on the planet.
Why not just put the two together? In other words, why did the NSA need to come about in the first place if you had the CIA?
Well, two completely separate, you know, focuses. I mean, the NSA is a, you know, it's a communications focused organization. The agency, again, the concept and still to this day, what it does is it acquires, it collects information, it steals information, it steals secrets. And that, you know, people may be aghast at that, but they better hope that the agency is good at it because the aggressiveness that other nations, every nation acts according to its own best interests, you know, and I know that sounds very simple, but sometimes we forget that because the U.S. sometimes is the only country that seems to apologize when we act in our own best interests. But the Russians, the Chinese, good God, the French, the Germans, every nation out there, to the ability of their resources, is aggressively taking information as quickly as they can gather it on us and everybody else, including their allies. That's why that whole thing with when the Snowden leaks in part talked about, you know, listening in on Angela Merkel's phone calls. What a joke. The German intel service is actively collecting information on its allies. The French, the former French intelligence service head, when the French president was complaining about, you know, oh my God, I can't believe the U.S. is doing this. The former head of the French intel service went at public and said, "What the hell are you talking about? It's exactly what we do."
Why are we collecting information on our allies?
You know what? Because it's national security, and you know, what are you going to do? Take the word of everybody. I mean, it'd be a lovely thing if we could just all hold hands, but I know that's not the way the world works. And you know, as much as we'd like it to be that way, you know, hope is not much of a strategy when you're talking about national security.
How important is torture in the world of espionage and getting information?
That's a loaded. What a loaded question that is.
No, I'm not going to dance around.
How important is torture? Well, torture. First of all, torture should not be used, and torture is not a good tool. I mean, just to be in a simple sense, using torture to collect actionable intelligence is not a good idea. It's never going to be a good idea.
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm being honest here. I mean, real view of the world, and I think that anybody sits there and tries to say that there isn't torture to get information. I don't believe them. I think it happens. I'm not saying I'm totally against it either. If it makes me safer, I don't want the wrong person to be tortured. But
here's where we differ. Here's where we differ. You're using the word torture, and I'm
saying enhanced interrogation because I'm going to slap.
Yeah, enhanced interrogation techniques because stress positions and qualified and controlled sleep deprivation noise and sensory deprivation, those things. You know what? They're enhanced interrogation techniques. Are they torture? Absolutely fucking not. You know, we went through all our guys in spec ops go through waterboarding. You know, really, we're going to torture our own people. Okay, fine. You know what? It's uncomfortable. It's not meant to be comfortable. But
I want you to tell me right now that you hooked a car battery up to a guy's balls. Just tell me that.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
That's what I want to hear. I'm an American.
What I do to myself in my own home, though, hey, that's my business.
What Theodore Loveland does to himself in his own home. All right. I love you like a brother, but you can call it an ants interrogation if you want. It's torture. And I'm not judging it, but it exists and it has some use, right?
Well, enhanced interrogation techniques have use, as does the element of surprise. I mean, it's a moot conversation because the president has removed that from the kit bag. He's basically said, look, here's the Army field manual. This is all we're capable of doing. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again. I couldn't break my teenage daughter with the Army field manual. And so you need to have the element of surprise. Even if you never go to an enhanced interrogation technique, you need to be able to keep them on their back foot. Otherwise, if you don't have that element of surprise, then all you're saying is, look, I'm just going to use as much time as it takes for me to develop a personal relationship with this high-value target to get them to talk to me in a reasonable fashion. And you know what? The agency got almost all of their good information by doing that, by talking, by developing relationships, by doing those sort of things, despite what the FBI might want to say. But that's exactly what happened. And on those occasions when you need to go to something else, then having that ability and not having the target think that, well, I know exactly what you can do, so I'm not worried, so I'm going to sit here all day long and I'm not going to tell you anything because I know exactly what's coming down the pike because I, too, have read the Army field manual. That's not a good thing.
That's what you mean by element of surprise. In other words, they need to not know that you can go off book, so to speak,
right,
within reason. And because, listen, I want, just as a friend, because my kid in a couple of years is going to start smoking pot and everything, and I want to be able to get information on him. Just give me one enhanced interrogation thing that I can use on him. Like, do I make him sit on like thumbtacks? Like, what do I do? Give me one thing that I can use on my kid.
Yeah, best thing you can do with your kid is just keep the line of communication open.
Oh,
just always
shut
talk
up.
To him. There you go. Look at that. How good am I? How good am I?
You're so bad. I got one more, two quick questions. One, when you're undercover like that, and there's a chance that you could be involved, you'd be the recipient of enhanced interrogation, do you think about your underwear? Do you think, I got to wear clean underwear? Do you wear like boxers or briefs? Because I would be conscious of that in the field as a CIA guy. Like, if I get caught and they like strip me naked down to my underwear, I want to look presentable.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the good thing is when you do get accepted and you get into the training, once you finish the training, they just sew your bunghole shut. So, you don't have to worry about that sort of thing.
Just tell people real quickly, in the private sector now with Diligence and what you do. I mean, obviously you can't reveal details, but you work for private entities, for companies, and kind of keep them safe from having their information stolen by competitors. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, in part. Yeah. I mean, I got very lucky, started the business with a very good friend of mine who came out of the British teams, and we've been very lucky in the people that we've hired and the folks that we've met and worked for. And so it's multinational corporations, it's financial institutions, large law firms, high net wealth individuals, some foreign government.
So I work in a law firm. So other law firms are stealing information from law firms? No,
because we do a variety of things. I mean, we've got teams that do nothing but, you know, very pedestrian due diligence and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act work. We've got folks that do investigative and litigation support and a lot of asset tracing. We do have folks that do competitive intelligence and strategic intelligence gathering. We've got a security services group. And so it's a computer forensics group. There's a lot of elements to it. At the end of the day, it's all information in some capacity that's, you know, either, you know, minimizing risk or maximizing opportunity. Listen to me. Mm-hmm. I should be on TV.
You are unbelievable.
For my company.
You are this is a little advertisement. And you're also on Travel Channel, America Declassified, and you're in your second season, so people should check that out. And
That'll be airing in the fall. We're in the middle of shooting stories for it now.
You go around the country. Yeah, you go around the country like trying like your favorite hamburger joint, right? It's like one of those shows, right?
Yeah, it's just like that. I just go places and eat food.
Mike Baker's, this week we're checking out pickles in Idaho, and you go eat pickles all for the whole show. All right, listen, this has been awesome. I hope my listeners love this as much as I did. Everything you said was cool. You're full of shit. We torture people, and that's what you call it. And
when I, you had to get that in.
When I see you, I'm going to punch you in the nuts when I see you. And I'm not, it's not enhanced interrogation. I'm Italian from Rhode Island. I'm just going to punch you in the nuts and say, I punched you in the nuts. I want people to say what it, but this has been fantastic. And we got to do another one.
There's going to be two Suburbans pulling up at your door. Don't answer the door, whatever you do. Don't answer the door.
Listen, whatever you do, make sure your underwear is clean. I don't want anybody to start torturing you and embarrass your family. This has been Mike Baker, CIA extraordinaire, field ops officer for 17 years, friend and fellow Red Eye compatriot. And thank you for doing this, buddy. You're the best.
Paul, thanks so much, man. I really enjoyed it.
All right, there you go. Mike Baker. That's a very cool world. I couldn't do it. I could. Nah, I couldn't. I think I'd wet myself if I had to be a covert ops guy. I can't handle tension and pressure. Go to my one-man show if you're in the area, New York City, one-man Broadway show, Paul Mercurio's Permission to Speak. It's on telecharge.com, and use the code PMFAN. You get 50% off, and please leave some nice comments on iTunes about the show. Always helps. All right. I'm going to miss you till next week.